The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 264, a paper entitled The 1950 Priesthood Split and Fundamentalist Mormons Today, with presenter Ken Driggs.
I want to just tell you a little bit about my background with these communities and then a little bit about the community. I first stumbled in, actually didn't stumble in, I deliberately went to Colorado City in January of 1988. After seeing something on TV. I'm a sixth-generation Mormon. I didn't even know there were fundamentalist Mormons till I saw this thing on 60 Minutes. So I went there out of curiosity, managed to sort of talk my way into the community, ended up making a lot of friends down there, and stay with families down there when I go visit, count a number of folks down there, and then later in some of the other communities among my best friends. Because I'm an attorney with an interest in this area, I ended up consulting with them a good bit on legal cases and still end up doing some consulting with them on these kinds of issues. And right after I went in for the first time, I started a graduate program in legal history at the University of Wisconsin, where to my surprise, my major professor suggested I do a thesis on the Vera Black case, a 1955 Utah Supreme Court decision involving the parental rights of polygamous parents. And that directly resulted in my starting to consult on cases. I later on met and got a lot of friends in the Apostolic United Brethren community, the Bluffdale community that the Allred family has historically been in the leadership of. So I tell you that just to let you know that I have a lot of friends. I tend to look at these folks sympathetically. I am not a fundamentalist Mormon. I'm active mainstream LDS in the Atlanta ward in Atlanta, Georgia. But I'm very sympathetic. And I've had a lot of intimate contact with these folks as a result of this, and then have done a lot of historical research. Another point I wanted to make is, as I talk about these groups today, I'm mostly going to talk about two groups that would be formally called the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is more or less headquartered in Short Creek, historical Short Creek area. It's called Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah. And the other group is called the Apostolic United Brethren, whose headquarters is more or less at Bluffdale down at Turn of the Mount. But they are by no means the only fundamentalist Mormon groups. And when you read about people who hold themselves out as fundamentalist Mormons, you need to keep in mind that there is a variety of groups, formally organized groups that have priesthood organizational structures, and then a lot of what are called independents, who don't affiliate with any group. And I found a certain number of people that have one foot in the big church and one foot in the fundamentalist world. So while I think the two groups I'm talking about today probably comprise a very large chunk of the whole community, I want to make it clear I'm not talking about the whole community or everybody. Okay, let me start by just talking a little bit about how fundamentalist Mormonism came into being. When the 1890 Manifesto came down and was adopted by the church, it was not uniformly accepted by rank-and-file members. There were dissenters. Plural marriage continued semi-officially in the church at least for a generation after the 1890 Manifesto. And some of the things that brought about the Manifesto and the conflicts of that the Mormon community had with the rest of the world involved things besides plural marriage. I think one of the unfortunate things about fundamentalism and Mormon history is people tend to get sort of mesmerized by plural marriage and don't recognize some of the other issues. But among the other issues that were important to people were changes in temple ordinances, changes in garments, priesthood garments or temple garments, the church's cooperative economy and how they related to the national economy, political parties, whether they, in Utah there was historically a Mormon political party, and then the church broke down into participating in the Republican and Democratic Party, a lot of other cultural issues. So it was not just limited to plural marriage. In 1918, Heber J. Grant became president of the church, and while he himself had plural wives earlier in his life, by that point in his life he had one wife. And he sort of went after these holdouts with a vengeance. And after 1918, you start seeing a lot more excommunications. You see more formal church assistance of criminal prosecution of fundamentalists. And for the first time, really began driving these people out of the formal church community. And for a time, his counselor in the first presidency was J. Reuben Clark, who was particularly active in this area. And this is jumping a little ahead in the timeline, but in 1933, Clark authored something that is generally called the Final Manifesto, which was this long sort of legalistic statement of church policy on plural marriage. It was read in every ward and published and circulated around. And they began to adopt, in some instances, a church loyalty oath, where if you wanted to maintain your membership in the church, you may be confronted with this oath and required to sign this. If you would not sign it, you would be excommunicated. And I'm just reading from a copy of the oath. You were required to pledge that I understand, the undersigned member of whatever ward of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, solemnly declare and affirm that I, without any reservation whatsoever, support the presidency and apostles of the church, that I repudiate any intimation that any one of the presidency or apostles of the church is living a double life, that I denounce the practice and advocacy of plural marriage as being out of harmony with the declared principles of the church at the present time, and that I myself am not living in such an alleged marriage relationship. Well, if you were unwilling to sign that oath, that was grounds for excommunication, and I found records of a number of people that have been excommunicated for declining to sign that oath. And I mentioned that just as sort of an indication of the climate. By the late 1920s, a man named Lawrence C. Woolley, who was a son of John W. Woolley, began to organize what is traditionally called a priesthood council. Lauren Woolley believed and taught that he and his father and others had been charged with a mission by President John Taylor to perpetuate plural marriage, to continue this practice in the church. And in 1929, he called a priesthood council for that purpose. And the members of the council were Lauren Woolley, J. Leslie Broadbent, John Yates Barlow, Joseph White Musser, Charles F. Zitting, Dr. LeGrand Woolley, and Louis Alma Kelch. And that council sort of was equivalent, I guess, to the Quorum of the Twelve, but not exactly. As I understand it, in this point in time, these folks saw themselves not as a separate church, but as a kind of a special priesthood quorum within the church charged with the responsibility of perpetuating certain things. And plural marriage being one of those things. But they also saw themselves as charged with continuing some sort of cooperative living effort. By the mid-1930s, they had gotten in touch with some conservative Mormons in what was then Short Creek and saw that as a place where they could perhaps live cooperatively, set up something that eventually became the United Effort Plan Trust, and they could live down there in this isolated place in plural relationships without legal pressures and conflicts from the outside world. In 1935, they began to publish a monthly magazine called Truth, which published for, I think, like 20 years or more. Through most of that period, Joseph Musser was the editor of Truth. And Musser is a son of Amos Milton Musser, who was an assistant church historian, and had access to a lot of materials from the church archives. And an awful lot of that got reproduced in Truth magazine. And I will tell you, as a researcher, when I first became aware of Truth and started looking at it and purchased a set of it myself, my first thought was, I don't know how credible this stuff is. How much can I rely on documents and so on set in there? And I will say that in every instance I've been able to track down the original document of the representations in Truth, I found that it is factually reliable. So I've come as a writer and researcher to rely on the representations that I see in Truth, and I recommend that to you as a source if you're trying to learn more about this community. All right. In 1935, Lauren Woolley had died, and he was succeeded by Joseph Leslie Broadbent, who lived for about 9 months, and then he died. And he was succeeded by John Yates Barlow as the senior in ordination and sort of the leader of the group. You may have heard about the Barlow family down in Colorado City. They're mostly children or grandchildren of John Yates Barlow. And so he places more emphasis, I think, than there had been before on the cooperative living arrangement down in Short Creek, spends a lot of time living down there. And they continue to publish Truth. The Depression puts an additional set of economic pressures on people. And interestingly enough, in research, I found that some of these early fundamentalist Mormons had been active with the Socialist Party in Utah and other places in the West. And so this interest in cooperative living showed up in some of their political instincts as well. In 1944, there was a major multi-state raid where a whole bunch of polygamists were rounded up by federal and state authorities in Utah, Idaho, Arizona, and I think some other states. The end result of that was 31 convictions and sentences of a year or more for those 31 people, although I'm not sure that everybody got sentenced to a year actually served the time. I was doing some research on this trip out here to try to nail down who just actually did time. A number of women got one-year sentences, and I can't find any evidence that any of them actually served the sentences. But 15 men were, by 1945, imprisoned in the state penitentiary. Just kind of to make note, those men were Rulin C. Allred, Albert E. Barlow, Edmund F. Barlow, Ianthus W. Barlow, John Y. Barlow, who was still leader at that point and was 71, Arnold Boss, Oswald Brainich, Heber K. Cleveland, David B. Darger, Joseph Lyman Jessup, who ends up being a wonderful source for me, Louis Alma Kelch, Morris Q. Kuntz, Joseph White Musser, who is 73 at this point, Alma Timpson, and Charles Zitting. Musser begins to he gives up the editorship of Truth Magazine to his son, Guy Musser, while he's in prison, and is never able to get that authority back from his son, Guy. He has a series of strokes and other health problems while he's in prison. He ends up losing, and more of these events after they're eventually paroled. He loses some of his, he has a speech impediment, and he loses some other motor control. Apparently is seriously disabled by this series of strokes. So these gentlemen are then paroled under various conditions. And on December 29th, 1949, President Barlow died at the Lincoln Street home. They had bought a pretty good-sized mansion on Lincoln Street. I think it was built in the 1890s, and redid the inside of it as a meeting place. It was a meeting hall. The building is still standing. I think some sort of venture capital outfit has it now, and they've considerably refurbished it. But the building is still standing. Some time ago, I got a tour of it, and some of the basic structures of the meeting rooms that the fundamentalists had set up for themselves were still in place there. But Barlow dies, he's 75 years old. So at that point, by order of ordination, Musser would have been the leader, the senior member of the quorum, or their priesthood quorum. He was 77 at the time. And there is almost immediately a lack of confidence, I'll say, by some of the other members of the priesthood quorum in his leadership. And they were just not prepared to give him that role. When Barlow is president, he appoints a number of other people to the priesthood council. It's become more than seven members by that point. And there's a kind of a, I guess, a period of ambiguity as to who the leadership is. When Joseph Musser is released from prison, he's going to the printer and going to his son, Guy Musser, trying to get editorial control of Truth back. Guy will not give it up. Musser is not able to continue his role as editor. He's frustrated by that. Kind of as a point in time, in 1950, Howard Pyle is elected governor of Arizona and almost immediately begins plans that would result eventually in the 1953 raid in Colorado City or Short Creek, where a number of people are arrested, and it's a big, major national news story. But that process starts with Pyle's election in 1950. So on May 6th, 1951, Musser announced to the group his intention to call Dr. Rulin Allred to the Priesthood Council. Now, who is Rulin Allred? He is the son of B. Harvey Allred, who was a state legislator in Wyoming and eventually became what amounted to a fundamentalist, had written a book, I believe it's called A Leaf in Review, about his convictions. And Rulin Allred is one of his kids. And at first, Rulin disagrees with his father. And there's this exchange of correspondence with them where Rulin is a committed member of the church, and in the course of that correspondence becomes convinced that his father is right and gains a testimony to fundamentalism, is excommunicated from the church, and he is married to a woman who is not a believer, and eventually begins to take plural wives himself. There is a divorce. Her name is Catherine States. I think eventually her married name is Catherine States. There's a very interesting file in the Brigham Young University archives of her letters and correspondence back and forth with Heber J. Grant about what she should do about her husband and all of this that has a lot of interesting family information in it. Allred was educated in Los Angeles as a naturopathic physician, and he had been treating Musser when he had these strokes. I don't know whether Musser had other medical treatment, but I do know that Allred was treating him. And I suspect that Allred may have been regarded by some of the other members of the Priesthood Council as kind of an interloper, a relative newcomer to the group. And for a lot of reasons, they resisted the idea of him being appointed a successor. And so this announcement by Musser is received with great coolness by the other members of the Priesthood Council. Now, one member of the fundamentalist Mormon group at the time is a man named Joseph Lyman Jessup. He is a son of Joseph Smith Jessup. I don't know how you could have a more Mormon name than that. The whole family becomes very involved with fundamentalism. And his father, Joseph Smith Jessup, is a stalwart down in Short Creek and actually remains with that community down there. But Joseph Lyman Jessup keeps very detailed diaries that are a really rich source. They have been published privately by the family. They're not available in bookstores or necessarily in libraries, but they're just a wonderful source of firsthand observation about some of this stuff. And much of what I'm going to follow with comes from his diaries. On May 27th, 1951, Jessup writes about this appointment. Brother Rulin Allred revealed to Marvin and Owen Allred, and this is the Owen Allred who died last February, Joseph Thompson and I many points of interest pertaining to the recent priesthood affairs showing the council's rejection of President Joseph W. Musser's revelation calling Rulin to assist him. Also that we, above mentioned, and Brother Esley Jensen, who was not present, have been called also to defend him and stand for the fullness of the priesthood upon the earth. I've been informed by Brother Joseph Musser himself of many out-of-order conditions of the priesthood council, as they are generally spoken of. And then he lists what he understood to be the council at that point: Charles F. Zitting, Leroy S. Johnson, J. Marion Hammond, Guy Musser, again Joseph Musser's son, Rulin T. Jeffs, who is the father of Warren Jeffs, that now is the leader of that community in Colorado City, Richard S. Jessup, Carl Holm, and Alma Timpson. Dr. LeGrand Woolley, who is also seems to be an avowed enemy of Rulin Allred. I don't know where Lewis Kelch stands, but these brethren have all taken a stand against Joseph and the calling of Rulin C. Allred. Though Joseph declared to me, as he held my hand, that Mel O. Richter sat beside me. Okay, well, that's not really relevant to what I'm talking about. There's another entry on July 24th, 1951, where Jessup writes, "The differences of understanding and expression continue between Joseph and Rulin and a few others and other members of what is called the Priesthood Council." And again, he lists the men that he understands to be on the council. "It just makes me know that none less than the one mighty and strong, Joseph Smith the prophet, can set in order the house of God, which first of all is the priesthood. Because of Joseph's sickness," referring to the strokes, "the council do not consider him head, and they will not recognize Rulin Allred's calling through him. I've had personal discussions with some, especially Brother Zitting, who will not recognize the priesthood conferred upon me and four others by Brother Lauren C. Woolley." On September 18th, 1951, Musser then formally ordains Rulin Allred to the Priesthood Council and designates him as second elder, which essentially makes him successor to Musser in the leadership. On December 6, 1951, Jessup describes this really bitter meeting, priesthood meeting, where the membership is arguing over this and they're sort of trading verbal hand grenades. And at that meeting, a vote is taken as to confirming or sustaining Musser as leader, and a majority of the Priesthood Council oppose sustaining him as leader of the Priesthood Council. So finally, on January 12, 1952, Musser, who was then just short of his 80th birthday, organized a new Priesthood Council, calls another group of men, and they are Dr. Rulin C. Allred, John Butcherett, Esley Jensen, Owen Allred. Owen is a brother of Rulin Allred and then succeeded Rulin Allred when he was murdered. Marvin Allred, who is another Allred brother, at Joseph B. Thompson and Joseph Lyman Jessup, the diarist that I've been reading. Then Jessup recorded, he wrote about the ordination in his diaries. Let's see. He says, by appointment, a few of us met at the home of President Joseph W. Musser in special priesthood meeting to learn from him more pertaining to our duty in support of the calling of Brother Rulin C. Allred to the second eldership and the threats against his life by some brethren. After listening to some queries from the mind of Brother John Butcherett, who humbly and tearfully expressed himself in desire to do nothing but the will of the Lord, Brother Rulin C. Allred again rehearsed to us that he had opposed his calling because of the feelings of some of the council members. He read from notes written under Joseph's direction by Lorna Allred some time ago. Joseph spoke pleasingly and frankly and stated the truthfulness of that report. Brother Rulin answered Brother Butcherich's, I know I'm not pronouncing that right, questions to his satisfaction. And then later on in the century, Jessup writes out what he thinks is the old priesthood council, that's the term he uses at the time, consisting of Charles Zitting, J. Marion Hammond, Guy Musser, Rulin T. Jeffs, Richard S. Jessup, Carl Holm, Alma T. Timpson, and Leroy S. Johnson. There's another entry, and then I'll stop reading from all these diary entries. But on August 24th, 1952, Jessup writes that Joseph Musser told us that whatever his former counsel did was without authority. And from now on, unless he sanctioned it, and then it is done by his authority, not their own. I don't know that this is what is in the future, but I hope something will happen to make them realize the precarious position they're in. And as I said, Musser was trying to get the editorship of Truth Magazine back. That failed, and he authorized his new priesthood council to begin publishing an alternative publication, which they called Star of Truth. It was also a monthly, and its first issue came out in January 1953. On March 29th, 1954, Musser died at his home. He was 82 years old. He was not hospitalized. There doesn't appear to have been any medical treatment of him at this point in time, although I think it was probably the practice to die at home at that point. His funeral was April 2nd, 1954, at the Larkin Funeral Home. And I'd noticed in going through these diaries and some other things I'd seen that quite frequently fundamentalist Mormon funerals were at the Larkin Funeral Home up in near Temple Square in Salt Lake. And I went up there once and located a young man, apparently the, you know, like the fourth generation Larkin, who was doing funerals up there, and talked to him a little bit about it. And he didn't have a whole lot of information to relate, but said that, yes, they had had a particularly comfortable relationship with fundamentalists. They went out of their way to make them comfortable and actually, I guess, actively courted their business up there, so it was not unusual. There's a very detailed account of Musser's funeral in a bunch of family papers in the Utah State Historical Society archives. It's like a transcript of the funeral service. And one thing you notice in there is that everybody who has anything to do with the funeral is a member of the old priesthood council. The new priesthood council is pretty much iced out of participation in the funeral services. I'm not quite sure what the cause of that was, but I was a little surprised when I read through that record to see that. With Musser's death, Rulin Allred succeeds him as the leader of what is today called the Apostolic United Brethren, AUB, which is headquartered in more or less in Bluffdale. If you're driving down the interstate and you go around that loop at Turn of the Mount, if you're looking off, if you're going south and you look off to the right, you can see their facility down there. It's a pretty large plot of land, and there's some like softball fields and green irrigated area around it, and I think an apartment building in there. It's very visible from the road. The first time I met with Owen, who actually became a pretty good friend of mine, he joked with me when he was giving me directions to his residence, which is also not far from there, that he lived very near the state penitentiary, but they hadn't been able to get him in there just yet. And Owen had a dry sense of humor. Rulin Allred continued to lead the group. I have read a couple of informal histories of the community that indicated that when this division came, most of the people in Colorado City or Short Creek, which is what it was called then, followed the old priesthood council. And there, it was a while before they really had a strongly designated leader, but eventually it evolved into Leroy Johnson, who led that group until much later in his life. But that group down there almost entirely followed the old priesthood council. The fundamentalists in the Salt Lake Valley split about 50-50 between the two priesthood councils. When you get to know this community, you find a lot of family last names that predominate, and you find almost all of those family last names appear in both groups, although you see a lot more Barlows down in Colorado City and more Jessups up here and more Allreds here, but you also find that last name in the other groups. In 1977, Allred was murdered by followers of, I always use this phrase, the crazed Erville LeBaron, and I don't know that there's any other adjective that applies to Erville LeBaron but possessed. His funeral was held at a high school, I forget the high school, but it was kind of a public coming out event for fundamentalist Mormons. The news accounts indicate that about 5,000 people came out. They had been not nearly so visible or public up to that time out of fear of prosecution and other sort of social sanctions. But that event was kind of an initial step in them becoming much more public and involving themselves with the outside world in a public way. Brother Jessup, our diarist, suffered a stroke of his own in April 1954 and stopped writing in his journals at that point. He died in 1963 in Murray, Utah. Leroy Johnson, who they call Uncle Roy down there, led the Colorado City group until 1986 when he died at age 98. And he designated his successor as Rulon Jeffs, who was one of those newer members of the Priesthood Council, the father of Warren Jeffs. Rulon Jeffs is an accountant, was a member of the mainstream church, served a mission for the church in Great Britain, and became the leader of that group with Leroy Johnson's death. I got kind of interested in this split partly because I think the personalities of the people who were in the split reflect an awful lot about the sort of institutional personalities of the organizations that have evolved out of it. And I want to talk about that a little bit. Eventually, Colorado City or Short Creek incorporated as the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the FLDS. That's a relatively recent event in the last 10 years or so. I have had people down there tell me that indicates a belief on their part that the LDS Church has lost its way to the point of where they don't call themselves a special priesthood quorum within the LDS Church, although I've observed that they do use a lot of LDS Church materials, hymnals and seminary books and things like that. If you go into their meetings, you'll see a lot of stuff that looks familiar to Mormons. The Allred group, as I understand it, do not see themselves as a separate church, a separate denomination. They do see the LDS Church as having a great deal of the truth, perhaps the truest church on the earth today, but not having the fullness of the priesthood, and they view themselves as a special priesthood quorum designated to continue the fullness of the priesthood. The Colorado City group, they still have a very functioning, vibrant priesthood council or governing body in the AUB group, the Allred group. And I'm going to come back to them in a minute. In Colorado City, it just sort of atrophied to where they really don't have anything even remotely equivalent to it today. They have a leader of the group, and they have evolved a belief that the leader of the group gets to designate their successor. It's not a matter of order of ordination or anything like that. Sometimes the designation of that successor is not done very publicly, and there is the perception, at least on the outside, that there's some infighting for leadership of the group. There was news accounts suggest there was some fear or some violence some fighting over this when Leroy Johnson died. Although I haven't found any evidence there really was anything, they fairly quickly seemed to coalesce around Rulon Jeffs down there as the subsequent leader. And the belief down there now is that when Rulon Jeffs died, he designated his son, Warren, to succeed him among many children. Warren used to teach in a parochial school they used to have up in one of the canyons here, and then they relocated all of that down to Colorado City. And my impression is that for some time late in Ruland's life, Warren was essentially calling the shots, was making the decisions down there. But it was pretty much one-man rule. Now, I contrast that with what I've observed in the AUB, a functioning priesthood council, and that became important because late in Owen Allred's long life, he was pretty infirm and pretty ill. I remember him telling me several times that he was ready to go home. He really was prepared to die. He was in a lot of pain and discomfort. And it was clear that he was not able to function in his leadership role. But they had this executive body, which I think is a bit like the Quorum of the Twelve in the big church when we have an older, infirm leader. The church continued to operate without any problems or indecisions because they had this functioning executive body. And late in Owen's life, there was a designation of a successor, and I gather that was discussed in the priesthood council. They didn't necessarily do it by order of ordination, and they agreed upon a successor to Owen Allred. That agreement was done before Owen died, and they had, as near as I can tell, a very smooth transition to the current leadership, current leader. And that, I think, only happens because of a priesthood council. I think another advantage of a priesthood council is you get a variety of voices. A council is a council. You got a bunch of people talking, expressing their opinions. In theory, you have people with a variety of skills and life experiences that enter into these discussions about the leadership decisions the church has to make. When you have a one-man leadership situation like they have in Colorado City, you don't necessarily have that council, and I think you increase the chances of people sort of spinning off in a direction that's not healthy for the community. And I'm careful about what I say, but my perception is that I think they're experiencing some of those difficulties in Colorado City today. The way I observe the AUB people being set up, I can't imagine that they would ever have the kind of problems that I think Colorado City has now, and it's because of that leadership style. As I understand it, the AUB has a strong emphasis on plural marriage. I think it is probably less of an emphasis than they have in Colorado City. Owen always made it very clear to me that he would not approve of or authorize the marriage of anybody under 18. He thought that was asking for trouble on a lot of levels. And he described to me instances where if a man came to him with a desire to take another wife, if Owen would frequently interview the pre-existing wives in the family to make sure they were okay with this. And if they weren't okay with this, he wasn't going to authorize the new marriage. And he indicated to me that he had some people leave his community because he was not prepared to authorize those marriages. On the other hand, Colorado City has had this model of arranged marriages where the prophet designates people to marry each other. The term they use down there is turning yourself into the priesthood. The belief is that when you reach a marriageable age, which is not necessarily 18, and I think that's where they invite some problems for themselves, your priesthood head, who is probably your father, but you know, you may have a family situation where your father's not appropriate role in that, turns you into the priesthood, which means that at that point then you are designated, a marriage is established for you. By you, I mean the woman, the wife, and then you enter into that marriage. Nobody puts a gun to your head and forces you to do this, but there are clearly some social sanctions, I guess, if you don't participate in this. And so the two models of marriage are very different from Colorado City and the AUB. And I think, again, that's a function of the split. Looking at some of Musser's writings and some diary accounts by other people, I've read in there where Musser apparently felt that John Y. Barlow was sanctioning the marriage of women under 18, and that Musser disapproved of this may have been quite vocal in his disapproval of this. Apparently, John Y. Barlow may have taught that it was a woman's obligation to have as many children as you possibly could, and it wasn't necessarily the wife's decision as to when you had those children. Musser apparently taught people that that was basically the wife's decision, that a husband should defer to the wife to decide when it was an appropriate time to have additional children. So there were differences in attitude that I think were manifested by the personalities of the men and then got carried on into the other organizations. I have another note here on differences, assimilation versus separation. I think many of you, if you live in the Intermountain West, probably have encountered people in the AUB and you never had any idea. not necessarily just the AUB, but many fundamentalist Mormons, because they didn't stand out to you in a way as really different. They were much more assimilated into the community. If you go down to Colorado City, you notice very distinct dress, and a number of the different groups have a kind of a distinct dress. And when you get sort of tuned into it, you can look at the dress and kind of figure out what their religious genealogy is. But there was just less of an emphasis on assimilation, I think, in Colorado City, more of an idea of isolation. My own interpretation of some of what's gone on down there is some of the conflicts have been the people who believed that they needed to assimilate and the people who opposed it, and that Warren represents that instinct that they should not assimilate, they should remove themselves from the world as much as possible. And I'm going to use Dan Barlow as kind of an example of this. Dan was the mayor. He's a son of John Y. Barlow, who was the mayor of Colorado City for a long time. He's one of the 1953 defendants in the raid. But Dan and I got to be good friends, and he's one of the people who's been excommunicated down there by Warren. But Dan had a strong sense of, we got to get jobs for our boys. You know, we got to live. You know, you got to pay the rent. You have to buy the food. And he recognized this economic tie, and he was anxious to try to develop the community in a way that helped them survive financially. And he recognized that a certain amount of assimilation was part of that process. And when they incorporated as towns down there, the town of Hilldale, Utah, and the town of Colorado City, Arizona, there was opposition to that because they thought that was engaging in the world too much. And then there were others who thought as a source of grants, sales tax revenues and things like that, that could help them build up the community. So that assimilation versus separation debate is much livelier down in Colorado. I won't say it's lively. I think it's kind of over. But it was much more of an issue down there than it was with the AUB people, who I think are clearly assimilated into the community and run businesses you do business with and are people you encounter who you might not guess. One other difference between the two groups, cooperative living, united order living, is an important goal for both groups. The Colorado City people have formed an entity called the United Effort Plan. It's a big trust that owns title to a lot of stuff, a lot of land and homes and businesses down there. And it is governed by a board of trustees. I think it's five members. But those articles of incorporation were redrafted sometime in the last few years to where the president of the church is the president of the board of trustees and everybody else serves at his pleasure. So basically the president of the church, Warren Jeffs, runs the UEP. There's not much room for alternative voices. I think that has caused some problems down there. The AUB has apparently more than one entity that incorporates their cooperative living. They have two or three cooperative communities that I'm aware of, and I think probably more that I'm not fully aware of. And they have a kind of an arbitration situation where if you live in one of these communities and you've built up a home and so on and you decide to leave, you can get reimbursed for some of your investments. They have an arbitrator who comes in and helps them establish what your reimbursement might be. The point being, the structure is much more flexible and much more prepared to accommodate people's needs in a modern world. And again, I think that's another thing that reflects the personalities maybe of the men who set up these groups and has a lot to do with why the AUB has fewer problems, I think, in the world today than the FLDS do. How much time do we have?
20 minutes.
Okay. Well, let me stop there and ask if anybody has any questions about any of this. Yes?
I've got a question. I'm from Texas. We've got a large fundamentalist group moving in there. They build a big temple around there.
That's the,
are they part of that group?
That's Warren Jeffs and the FLDS. I practice law in Texas. I'm a member of the Texas Bar, and I could have told them that was not a good idea. But yes, well, I mean, you know, West Texas, they think regular Mormons got one big eye in the middle of their forehead, and you drop in 400 polygamists with funky dress. It was just not a good plan. But yes, that is the group. I've been hearing rumors that they may be sort of moving out of there. Warren Jeffs is the leader of that group. Yes, he is. Yeah, I've talked to that sheriff on the phone two or three times to kind of make him aware that I'm available as a resource. I couldn't tell you. The great majority of their members still seem to live in Colorado City. I think some of this is complicated by a lawsuit. There was one of these priest child molestation suits that was brought against Warren Jeffs, couple of his brothers, and the UEP. Now, I'm in the past, I have known Warren quite well. I haven't really had much of a conversation with him in the last 5 or 6 years. It is just unfathomable to me that Warren would have participated in the conduct that is alleged in the suit. I don't know the brothers. I don't know anything about them. But they were sued. And the UEP was sued also. It's obviously the deep pocket theory. Warren and the brothers don't have any money. Where's the money? Let's go sue the UEP. So they sued the UEP on the theory that Warren was the president and on the board of trustees, therefore they have vicarious liability. Well, the problem with that theory is, at the point in time when this misconduct is alleged to have happened, Warren had nothing to do with the UEP. The UEP has no legal liability whatsoever for conduct in that period of time. But Warren apparently instructed his attorneys not to respond to the lawsuit, to let a default judgment be entered, which means the plaintiffs get the UEP. Which is just disastrous for all those people in that community. And as I understand it, the court down there now has dismissed Warren and the old trustees of the UEP. They've appointed a kind of a conservator to look after that funds, and there may be the appointment of a new board of trustees. I'm concerned that the new board may be people who also have an agenda to dismantle the community. It needs to be people who are sympathetic to the community. And I think Warren's going to Texas had something to do with that litigation. Yeah, they came out of Colorado City. It's on the Arizona-Utah border. Yes?
Yeah, two questions. The Christian Council's kind of refusal to endorse Joseph Mustard, is that based on his ability to use drugs or from what he was doing? I mean, not that those are necessarily separate, but
Well, all I can respond to is the records that I have found available to me on that, and they are partisan records on the Musser side of the split. Those, and that principally the diaries of Jessup, and he indicates it was because of his disability, because of the stroke, that they just weren't willing to follow him. I've had people in Colorado City who relate to me in oral tradition that they felt he was just so disabled he couldn't function. So,
I mean, I guess this is a rhetorical question, but
Well, I'm not here to tell you these positions are consistent. I'm just relating what the record has shown me.
Do you find irony there, too?
No, I do see the irony in that. But frankly, I felt like the split had as much to do with personality conflicts as anything. I think Musser and John Y. Barlow were very different personalities. My reading of Musser, and I'm working on a biography of Musser, too, is that he was much more urbane and red and sort of a city guy. And I think John Y. Barlow was just kind of a rough-hewn country guy. I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but they were just really different personalities. And I think the reason that so many people followed Barlow in Colorado City is that he was more like them and the kind of folks who relocated down there. I don't know much about him. I don't have much information on him. Let me get your question, then I'll come back to Leo.
Centennial City, what group is that?
Centennial Park. When late in Leroy Johnson's life, there were a couple of surviving members of the old priesthood council. He was in his home, unable to attend meetings and actively participate in the leadership of the church. And some of these other priesthood council members really began to assert themselves and their influence much more. And at some point, Musser, as they relate it down there, rose up out of his sick bed, came to church, denounced those members, basically kicked them out of the church, and they and their families and followers ended up relocating and creating what is Centennial Park. That's my understanding of that history. But they come from Colorado City. And that split came around 1980, 79, 80, something like that.
Yeah, it came in 1986, because that's why it's called Johnson, not Musser.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say Johnson, yes. Leo.
I remember a kind of a compound or commune between Spanish Fork and Springville that I thought was connected to Rulon Allred in the late 1950s. Do you know anything about that?
I can't answer that. 91. I can't answer that question. I know there are some AUB communities down there. There were some LeBaron family communities down there. And the Colorado City people have had some outposts up there. I'm not sure which one you're talking about, but there are lots of little communities sort of spread around down there. Just to point out another one, when Owen Allred died, his funeral services were in a community called Rocky Ridge, about an hour south of Salt Lake, as you're going south to the right off the interstate. I'd never been there until the funeral services, and it was a pretty substantial community with a large meeting hall that handled, you know, many hundreds of people. So, yes?
Tom Green, an independent fundamentalist, has a unique interpretation of word wisdom.
Yes.
Does the word wisdom within the two groups mirror the LDS current interpretation of word wisdom, how they interpret it?
No. It is my understanding, first of all, that the current LDS church interpretation of the word of wisdom is a creature of Heber J. Grant. It became a temple recommend question during the administration of Heber J. Grant. It was considered advisory before that. I have seen people in Colorado City have a beer in my presence without any misgivings about it, or a cup of coffee. I can't recall that I've ever seen anybody smoke down there. And frankly, I just don't recall observing any of that one way or another with the AUB people. My own take on the word of wisdom is that polygamy had become a kind of a litmus test for Mormon identification. And in the absence of plural marriage after the manifesto, they were looking for sort of other things as kind of litmuses, and word of wisdom became sort of elevated as part of that process. That's my own take on that. Leo's shaking his head. Yes?
Another question. With Todd Compton's work and some other things with Michael Quinn, with polyandry becoming a lot more prominent, and they look back at keeping the pure version of church and the success of that. How they have dealt with this new information coming out about Joseph Smith not being as being polyandrous, polygamous, truly polygamous, rather than polygynist. How they deal with that?
Well, most of the just conversation I've heard from my fundamentalist friends is they were anxious to get the book, read it quickly, and seemed to feel validated by that being placed in the historical record. I mean, that's the reception that I've observed. I don't know if that answers your question, but
the contradiction of him marrying other people that were already married to someone else, like Mary Elizabeth Rollins or et cetera, didn't bother them one bit.
I can't say that I've had that kind of an in-depth conversation with somebody about those kinds of issues. I have, from some of my own reading, observed that in the territorial period, the church often did things like family law through bishops' courts, which non-Mormons did not recognize. And you get the situation where people's marriages to a Gentile are dissolved in a bishop's court, and they remarry somebody else. And meanwhile, this non-Mormon person sees this as adultery and really offensive. And I think part of the idea of establishing the kingdom of God, having a bishop's court to resolve those things, was consistent with that. And I suspect that I would hear some of that from my fundamentalist friends if I asked them that question. Yes?
I remember the Kingston group is a totally different
group. They are a different group. As I understand it, they're also sometimes called the Davis County Cooperative. There's a lot of association between them and this priesthood council I'm talking about. But in the mid-1940s, I think they separated themselves and began to create the community that they now have. And I can't recall that I've heard very much connection back and forth between them, or, you know, dialogue or conversations. I can't recall hearing much discussion about Kingston connections.
How active a group are they? They're fairly secretive, aren't they?
They appear to be. I mean, I've gotten so involved with Colorado City and the AUB, I haven't really branched out to make those contacts yet. I think they are smaller than the AUB in Colorado City by a good bit. What are they, a couple of thousand? Would anybody agree with that?
Well, I think they're less than a thousand.
Less than a thousand? Anyway, and I it's hard to tell. Sometimes they're as much business as anything else from what I've read. Yes?
I've lived in St. George a month, and I've noticed dozens of fundamentalist shoppers at Walmart on the weekends. And the women dress very distinctively, but you can't tell that the men are fundamentalists. Is there some chauvinism demanding more strictness among the women?
Well, I think if you look at the men, they're going to be wearing long sleeves all the time, and they're not going to be in shorts, and you'll see the garments. And
they don't have to stand out like the women do.
Well, I think the women are probably more distinct because of their belief about makeup and jewelry, although I have known people, young women in Colorado City in perfectly good standing, that wore some makeup and jewelry and were pretty assertive. I don't think the men have nearly as distinct an appearance, but they do. You're not going to see beards and mustaches on them. They're going to be sort of short, closely cropped hair. They're going to be socially conservative in appearing. But when it's 110 degrees down there and you see them out there in their long jeans and long sleeve shirts, you'll think there's something different about that. So, yes?
You mentioned these journals, Truth. I wondered if they're available in libraries, research libraries.
I think a lot of research libraries will have them. It's been reprinted. I think it's probably available for purchase in reprint form. And are you?
Our book says, yeah, there are 21 volumes.
Yeah, the University of Utah library has a complete, I went through.
Yeah. You can buy them, but the reprints probably are easier to buy. But you said Benchmark, you can buy reprints from Benchmark?
You do have them.
Yeah.
What about Star Truth? Where's that available?
I bought a set from Zion Bookstore. I don't know if they still have it. But did I see another question? Yes.
How large is this Bluffdale group?
Well, that's the Apostolic United Brethren. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. I would say 7,000 to 9,000, 10,000 maybe.
No, among us,
5,000 to 6,000.
Do they live among us, or are they all out in Bluffdale?
No, they live. They're spread out around. They live right among you.
Kind of low profile. We don't.
Well, part of that is they're not getting in a lot of trouble, and you know, let me. Given this is Utah, you know, where attitudes can be pretty strong about some of these things. And if you're a businessman and you're doing business with the public, who probably is largely mainstream church members, you're not going to put a big sign up over your business and say, I'm one of those guys, you know, because you're going to be concerned about loss of business. If you got kids in public school, they're liable to get picked on a little bit. I can think of a lot of reason why people would deliberately keep a low profile. But they are, yes, they are among you, and my suspicion is you probably know and deal with some people who are members of that community and you don't necessarily know it. But with the Colorado City people, there are going to be a number of distinct things that would signal. Yes?
The Bountiful British Columbia Group, they're associated with the United Effort Plan, aren't they?
They used to be associated with, it's a Blackmores, the prominent family there. They used to be associated with Colorado City. When things started coming apart in Colorado City, there was a division. And I think some of them have kind of now broken off. They were an independent group at one point and then came in and joined the Colorado City group. And I just think that's kind of going the other direction now. But they also have some people, I think, that are still followers of Warren Jeffs. So that's a thing in transition. Yes? Do you know how big that community is?
There's about 800, there's 400. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Well, for Woodruff, Growth Manifesto, there's some indication that it was pretty easy to do that, seeing that the end of the world he saw very imminent. And then when that didn't happen, and how do these groups, do they have a more or less look at things that the world's coming really soon, so it's okay to do things that you wouldn't normally do? Because I remember my sister got married in 1960, and she said she felt like she needed to get married right away because the end of the world was coming really soon, but it didn't happen. So how many false alarms do they have, and they get close to the seeing that the world is going to come to an end and then it doesn't happen? Neither of the two groups.
My impression is that Warren Jeffs has preached those kinds of sermons some since he's been president, and that's had something to do with some of their decisions. I myself have not heard such a sermon or teaching from the AUB community. I'm not going to tell you absolutely that that's not part of their teaching, but I have not heard something like that.
Well, it's a catch-22. It works simply. All you've got to do is say, you weren't worthy. You didn't do what I told you to do. Therefore, the world didn't come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
It's slick.
Yeah.
You can't lose.
Yes?
Joseph Smith said at one point in Missouri, he said, there are two things I don't know. One, when they're coming.
I want to mention one other thing I haven't actually touched on. I actually was living in Texas when Waco and the Branch Davidians happened. I was practicing law in Austin, which is not too far from Waco, when that happened. And when the FLDS relocated to Texas, Texas people are a bit more sensitive on that kind of an issue. And I heard a lot of people suggesting, and I saw it in the media sometimes, are they another Waco or are they another Jonestown or something like that? I have to tell you, I think that is just simply not a threat with Colorado City people. I've known too many of those people too well, too long, to think that anything like that is possible. I do think pressures from the outside could be brought to bear on them that would be most unhelpful, but I don't see a tradition of violence. I don't see that kind of tradition with them at all.
So you don't see it in the personality of Warren Jeffs, because he's kind of he's got a little bit of instability there.
Well, I don't.
To the Inside Edition thing, he made some very racist things about blacks being mongrels,
Well, that's a long ways from that, from bringing out the poison Kool-Aid, you know, or a shootout. I mean, first of all, I can't see Warren Jeffs directing something like that. And admittedly, I haven't been around him in a long time. And even if he did, I just can't see. I mean, it's not like those people are robots, you know.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Well,
no, I mean, and that's why I mentioned outside influence being a problem, and that's why I called that sheriff to say, you know, I know these folks and I'm available to you.
Not like that, not there. They have some real serious problems.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I understand they've done not recently, but sometime in the last 10 years, is if you're a member in good standing in Colorado City, you're not expected to have a firearm. Their firearms are not considered something you should have in the community. I just cannot see amongst my friends down there them considering participating in something like that. So I think that is just not a valid concern. I am a little concerned about some of the political rhetoric I've heard sometimes from the Attorney General and other people here. I think is unhelpful in trying to resolve these issues. But
you've never heard the news like the Zionists.
I've heard some of that sort of I've heard some pretty hard right-wing politics, but I don't have to go too many blocks from my home in Atlanta, Georgia to hear that. I mean, we got congressmen in Georgia who talk about that every day. So I don't consider anything they say to be of the type that would make me concerned about violence from them. Yes?
Do you have any thoughts or opinions as to whether the current leadership in Colorado City is sending away young boys so that there will be more girls than the other?
You're talking about the Lost Boys stuff?
Yeah.
I don't think they are necessarily consciously sending them away. I think there are always sort of tensions with young people, teenagers getting some exposure to the outside world and not living by the norms of the community. The community's got pretty rigid norms. I'm not saying I don't think people have not been suggested to leave. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that happened. Now, I've heard pretty high numbers quoted, which I'm just not prepared to believe. I mean, I don't see it happening. Somebody this morning used the figure 700 or 800 people, boys, sounding like it was recent. I'm just not prepared to accept that. But I certainly know of people who have left, and I know people who have left and have come back, men and women. So I'm not saying that is not a problem. I think there are a lot of problems down there, but I think the size of the problem has been blown out of proportion considerably. Let me.
Yes. Temple suddenly appears. We didn't get to hear about it.
Well, I don't know that anybody was looking. I can tell you those people are hardworking and industrious, and if they want to build something, they'll build it fast. One of the times when I was in Colorado City, they decided they wanted to build a home in 24 hours from the ground up as kind of a community project to show everybody what we can accomplish when we work together, and they went from a hole in the ground to a finished home in 24 hours. I saw that process happen. So, yeah, when they get together and want to work on a project, it wouldn't surprise me at all that they could build something like that pretty quickly.
What exactly prompted them to build the temple, the timing and that? What factors? Because that's a major project.
I could not tell you.
Because the temple ordinance has always been important in the fundamentalist movement.
Well, I can tell you that when I've asked about that issue with my Colorado City friends, the answer I've always gotten is it isn't the place, it's the priesthood power. That they didn't feel a need for an edifice or a building to accomplish these things validly. They felt that the person performing the ordinances had to have the proper priesthood authority. You had a question.